and I hope everyone is well. I know this is a very difficult, and challenging time for everyone. There is both the fear of the coronavirus and there's the severe dislocation imposed by isolation. And I spoke last week about some messages of hope and faith, that on one hand, we do have to be very meticulous in obeying the directives of the Ministry of Health or whatever health authority you're dealing with. On the other hand, we also have to be hopeful and optimistic and courageous and understanding that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will ultimately take us out of this great tzara. Indeed, we're entering the month of Nisan, and this is, there's never an auspicious time to have a plague, so to speak. If God forbid, there is such a plague that we are being afflicted with, the month of Nisan is the best time to have it, because this is the month of redemption, and this is when God takes us out of our matzav, and all of us pray that Yehi Ratzon, we should experience once again a yitziyah, an exodus, from all of these plagues. But in truth, the old saying, which is a secular saying, that every cloud has a silver lining, is even true in the wake of this corona epidemic. First of all, it makes us understand the utility of technology. It's true that we're not able to get together personally, that we are to some degree socially isolated. A minyan halachically cannot be created through virtual Zoom or Skype or whatever. But nevertheless, technology does give us the chance to spread Torah. I can tell you that in many places in the United States, they do have virtual minyan in the narrow sense that they do not recite the Kedusha or the Kaddish or anything that requires a minyan, but at the same time, they can recite the prayers that you could recite as an individual, and they can do so in the context of a community, and I think that has a very therapeutic effect. You know, people knock the internet all the time, and indeed there's a lot to criticize in the internet. In my neighborhood there are constant wall posters talking about you're not allowed to have it. And, you know, again, one could discuss that. That's maybe a topic for another time. But in times of crisis, I think we do understand why HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed such a technology to enter the world, because it can really be a force for good. It can keep us together even if we're not able to be physically together. So I hope that everybody will keep up their connections, whether it's by the low technology of the telephone or the more advanced video conferencing, Zoom, and the like, that we keep up both our friendships and our Torah learning, our spiritual development, the chizuk and courage that we can give to each other, and God willing, that will be a tremendous factor that will bring us through this very difficult and challenging time. There's another point I want to underscore in terms of the silver linings within the cloud. You know, all of us know that the Torah has a law of nida, that when a woman has her period, there is a compulsory separation from marital intimacy. The Torah provides it for 7 days for various halachic reasons. It presently is at a minimum of 12 days a month. And although we don't know the reasons for the Torah, but Chazal give us a possible understanding that the compulsory separation means that when husband and wife finally get reunited, there's a certain excitement, a certain sense of renewal. The old saying, absence makes the heart grow fonder. And therefore, a compulsory separation is a way of keeping a relationship alive and vibrant and exciting. Our relationship to Eretz Yisrael is that way. When the great Rav Huttner made Aliyah towards the end of his life, he was asked, was there anything he missed about living in Chutz La'aretz? And he responded, I missed the yearning I had to come to Eretz Yisrael. And this is an interesting paradox. You know, when you're not here, when you're not in Yerushalayim, you're not in Eretz Yisrael, you think about, oh, I'm so excited about the possibility of coming here. Once you're here, you take even Yerushalayim for granted. So, consequently, one of the gifts of Galut in general is it can actually increase and accentuate our yearning for redemption, our yearning for Eretz Yisrael, our pining for the Beit HaMikdash. And that in turn becomes a merit that brings the Beit HaMikdash. So let's look at it in terms of what's happening with Corona. many, many shuls have closed down. Most of the Orthodox synagogues in the United States are not functioning. In Eretz Yisrael, a number of shuls have closed down. Other places do continue to have minyanim. I'm not going to give any psak about this. But one of the sad aspects of not having a Beit Knesset, we're really, really being deprived of minyan, of tefillah b'tzibur, of connecting to God in a very, very special way. But what that does is that makes us appreciate what it means to have a shul, to have a minyan, to have a tzibur. And when this crisis is over, and it will be over, b'ezrat Hashem, and we go back to our shuls, we go back to our minyanim, and next Pesach we'll go back to our crowded Pesach sedarim filled with children and grandchildren, in which people can cough and sneeze on each other with impunity. Right, that'll be one of the great, great, great brachas, that somebody can sneeze on you without you getting a heart attack. At that point, we'll appreciate the gift of family and the gift of community and the gift of Beit Knesset and the gift of Tefillah B'Tzibur. And that'll become much, much more precious in our eyes, precisely because we've been deprived of it. So in a sense, all of these deprivations are really preparing us for something better and something good. And Yehi Ratzon, may be God's will that it come very, very soon. I want to talk a little bit about Pesach. We do have holiday of Pesach coming, Yetziat Mitzrayim. And for those of you that follow these shiurim, a few weeks ago, Parshas Vaera, I spoke about the four cups of wine. I'm going to speak about the four cups of wine tonight. It is not a repeat shiur. It is a totally different shiur. So you can actually look at Vaera for one interpretation of the four cups of wine. And tonight I'm going to give you a totally different interpretation. So these are two separate shiurim. Do not worry. And that is, all of us know that one of the mitzvot of the Seder night is that we are obligated to drink four cups of wine. This is a rabbinic commandment. Unlike the eating of matzah and the recitation of the Haggadah, which is biblical, the drinking of the four cups of wine is a rabbinic mitzvah. And interestingly enough, the Babylonian Talmud does not give a reason for it. It's very, very fascinating. It presupposes that there is such a mitzvah, and it gives you many, many halachot regarding the four cups of wine. But there is actually no statement in the Babylonian Talmud for the reason of the takana of the four cups of wine. The closest we can come to is a reason that it is reflective of four different stages in the Seder itself. There is the Kiddush stage, and that's one cup. There's the Haggadah stage, which is the second cup. There is the benching, which is the third cup. And there is the Hallel, which is the fourth cup, meaning you're kind of working backwards. Since you have these four parts of the Seder, each one should be honored with a cup of wine. But the well-known reason that even every child in Cheder generally knows is actually from the Talmud Yerushalmi. It is not in the Bavli. And the Talmud Yerushalmi says that the reason for the four cups of wine is to correspond with four terms of redemption that Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu when he told them to go inform the Jewish people, I'm taking them out of Egypt, Vohotzeisi, I will take them out, Vehitzalti, I will save them, Vegoalti, I will redeem them, Volokachli etchem li liam, I will take them unto me for a nation. And even though there is a fifth phrase right afterwards, Heveti etchem el haaretz, I will bring them to the land, we understand, indeed, that is why there is one opinion in the Gemara that says you're supposed to have five cups. This is the opinion of Rabbi Tarfon. And some of the Gaonim actually paskin like Rabbi Tarfon. And even the Maral of Prague says that it's not a chiyuv to have a fifth cup, but it's a proper minhag. But basically, the overwhelming majority of Kol Yisrael do not have a fifth cup because we regard Veheveti as a messianic prophecy that will not be fulfilled until the final redemption. And therefore we have Elijah's cup, which we're holding for the coming of Mashiach, which is on the table, but we actually do not drink. So this is the well-known idea, though, that the four cups of wine, or grape juice, if necessary, are keneged, they correspond to the Arba Lashonot of Geula, the four terms of redemption. Question is, why do you need four terms of redemption? Redemption was one event. Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim. What is the tachlit of four terms of redemption? So a few weeks ago, I went over one understanding which correlated it to the four exiles. Tonight, we're going to have a different approach, which is based on the Meshech Chochmah of Rav Meir Simcha HaKohen. And he points out that although Yitziat Mitzrayim may have been a unitary event, there were four distinct dangers that the Jewish people faced. And because there were four distinct dangers, they needed, as it were, to be redeemed from each distinct satana. And each Lashon of Geula corresponds to a particular danger that the Jewish nation faced. Danger number one was simply the danger to our physical survival. A slave nation, just as in the Holocaust, we were beaten, we were oppressed, we were sometimes starved. Our children were thrown into the water, our children were sometimes thrown into mortar and incorporated into buildings. There was a real fear that there could have been a total genocide of the Jewish people over the course of time. And that is sakana number one, the danger to our physical existence. Sakana number two, danger number two, is a danger to our spiritual existence. Chazal actually teach us that the Jewish people in Mitzrayim, and we should have been there for 400 years, and we only stayed there for 210 years, because we had reached the 49th level of impurity, and we were slipping fast. And according to Kabbalistic teaching, whatever the 50th level means, once you hit the 50th level, you have reached a point of no return, and you're no longer redeemable. The Arizal says, when the Torah says they had to have matzah because they didn't have time to let their dough rise, the Arizal says that doesn't just mean Paro was kicking us out. It means God said, you have to leave now, because if you stay even the few minutes that it takes for dough to become chametz by rising, you would have hit level 50. We would have hit level 50 in a number of minutes. We don't even understand that. That's how difficult, spiritually, we had descended. And indeed, that's the one-fifth that survived. Remember that four-fifths of the Jewish people were killed in the plague of darkness. And that's understood to mean they had hit the 50th level. So if danger number one is to our physical existence, danger number two is spiritually. We would have been totally assimilated to Egyptian culture, Egyptian mores. Slavery takes a toll in terms of someone's spiritual existence and not only their physical one. Danger number three, Rav Meir Simcha says, which is why we're going to have four Lashonot of Geula, is that a slave has no sense of history. Those of you from the United States may remember a number of years ago, actually goes back to the 1970s, quite a long time ago, the phenomenon of roots. Alex Haley wrote a book that was based on his African roots. Again, some of it had been wound up to be falsified, but basically it talked about the story that the African slaves who were brought to the United States, many of them had royal roots. They go back to very, very eminent families of their countries. And one of the great tragedies of slavery is that a slave has no sense of where he comes from. He has no sense of his history. He has no sense of his roots. He has no sense that he comes from people of accomplishment and greatness, even if in fact they did. It's as if you were just born out of nothing. And that too afflicted the Jewish people. The Jewish people are slaves. They come from the great righteous Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the Shiftei Kah. But in the course of being beaten and subjugated and humiliated, at some point, you just forget where you come from. And as the old saying goes, if you don't know where you come from, you can't have a sense of where you need to go, because you simply don't know who you are. You were robbed of your essential identity. And the fourth danger of slavery is lack of hope that the future can ever be better. A person is so crushed by the vicissitudes of life, by the affliction, by the torture, by the humiliations, that they no longer have a vision of an alternative. that can be different, that can be better. Losing hope is a very, very fundamental self-fulfilling prophecy, even medically, and this is a little relevant to the coronavirus as well. It's well documented. It's like a reverse placebo effect. If a person believes their situation is hopeless and they're not going to recover, the body starts shutting down in irreversible steps. That is the mind over matter. That is the negative side of the psychosomatic condition in which the mind controls the body. And when a person loses hope, that's kind of the end of things. So Bekitzer, the Meshech Chachma is positing that the reason why we have four Lishonot of Geula is because there were four dangers the Jewish people faced. A danger to their physical life, a danger to their spiritual essence, a lack of a sense of history, and a lack of hope that the future can ever be different, can ever be better. And Hashem redeemed us in spite of these four things. But what's interesting is, in order to be zocha, in order to merit HaKadosh Baruch Hu's redemption, there has to be some behavior on our part that elicits that redemption. Now, we don't have to meet God halfway. Chazal used an expression, a beautiful expression, that God says, open up for me like the eye of a needle, and I will open up for you like the portals of the Beit HaMikdash, which are very wide gates. So we don't have to do that much, but we have to do something. In Kabbalah, this goes by the Aramaic term, Isarusa Dilatata. There must be an awakening from below to open up the channels of benevolence and goodness that comes from above. The Itaruta Dilatata, even if it's very small, brings Itaruta Dilayela, the awakening from above. So what was the Itaruta Dilatata of Bnei Yisrael that elicited God's redemption? What behaviors on our part countermanded those four dangers that enabled God to therefore redeem us in whole from those four dangers? So here, the Meshech Chachma makes a beautiful connection. There are various lists, because after all, the Jewish people were on the 49th level of impurity. If they were on the 49th level of impurity, then why did they merit to be redeemed at all? And there are various lists that talk about residual merits the Jewish people had. The Meshech Chachma uses the list that appears in the Mechilta. Now this might be slightly different than some of the listings that many people have heard of, but we're going to use this one. This is what he uses. The Mechilta tells us there were four merits the Jewish people had which enabled them to be redeemed from Mitzrayim. Number one, they did not intermarry. They remained faithful to their wives. Wives remained faithful to their husbands. There was preservation of the family unit, and that was a great merit that enabled us to be redeemed. Merit number two, they did not speak lashon hara against each other. Now, here I need to clarify what the Mechilta means. The Mechilta does not mean they were frum and they were keeping the laws of the Chafetz Chaim, not speaking lashon hara. Rather, this refers to more of a, what you might call a group solidarity. Meaning to say, we know in times of crisis, when people's lives are at risk, there is sometimes a tendency to turn against your fellow in order to secure temporary advantages from the ruling authority. Tragically, this occasionally occurred even during the Holocaust itself, where one Jew might inform on another Jew in order to get some food or freedom. Usually it was illusory, usually it did not pan out anyway, but there was such an attempt. When Chazal say the Jewish people did not speak Lashon Hara, it means they kept the united front. They did not turn against each other in order to secure some momentary advantage or privilege. In fact, even the people that we know as kind of the bad guys, Dasun and Aviram, they were the troublemakers in the desert. But you know, they were taskmasters in Egypt. And if a Jew did not meet his quota and the Egyptians looked at the numbers and they wanted to know who didn't do their job today, Dasun and Aviram took a beating rather than reveal something about the Jewish slave. That is why, by the way, they made the cut. One wonders if four-fifths of the Jewish people died. So only the one-fifth that's the most, relatively speaking, the most righteous left. How does Dasun and Aviram leave? The answer is they were quite righteous with respect to not turning against another Jew. Now, I have a theory, I have no proof of this, that this was actually the source of their animosity to Moshe Rabbeinu. I think from a human perspective, we can understand it. Because here are these two guys who are in the trenches. They're being beaten because they're standing up for their fellow Jews. And here comes this guy, Moshe Rabbeinu, who, number one, grew up in the royal house of Paro, never experienced slavery. And number two, then leaves Egypt and spends many years in Midian. And now he comes back, and he is the leader, and he is the big shot, and he is the king. They could feel from a human, now obviously this is totally incorrect thinking, but from a human perspective, they could say, why should he be our boss? We're the guys who were beaten. Again, totally erroneous, improper, sinful, and Dasun and Aviram, of course, died with Korach in the desert. But from a human perspective, one has to appreciate that even the negative figures in the Dor HaMidbar were quite righteous in certain respects. So, zechut number one, merit number one, to review, was faithfulness in the marital bond. Merit number two was the group solidarity of not speaking Lashon Hara. Merit number three, they didn't change their names. They kept their Jewish names. And merit number four, they didn't change their language. They continued to speak the Hebrew language, Lashon HaKodesh, the Holy Tongue. So here's what the Meshech Chacham is going to do, quite ingeniously. He's going to correlate these four behaviors to the four dangers that we faced. And each of these behaviors countermands the danger, and that is what is called the Asarusa Dolatata, the awakening from below, that elicits God's redemption. And we'll start with the Lashon Hara first. If danger number one was to our physical survival, the greatest antidote to physical danger is unity, caring about each other, not speaking Lashon Hara, which is really symptomatic of Achdut, unity, in Avat Yisrael. I believe it was Benjamin Franklin who said, I'm not sure if it was at the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, we must all hang together or we shall surely hang separately. And that's an important message, I think, for Klal Yisrael. It is understood that when there is Achdut, when there is unity, when there is Avat Yisrael, God is going to protect us from external enemies. But when we are divided against ourselves, we become weak, we become vulnerable, we become open to all the enemies that try to destroy us. So therefore, the not speaking Lashon Hara, which as I explained, was not a matter of frumkeit. It was a matter of solidarity and achdus and avat Yisrael. That is what ultimately protected us physically from being destroyed. Because when we turn against each other, we are vulnerable. This is why I've mentioned before that every year there are surveys in Israel in which people are asked to list the greatest problems that the Jewish people and the Jewish state face. Unfortunately, we have quite a big list, whether it's Iranian nuclear weapons, Islamic fundamentalism, bioterrorism. This year, of course, we have a new thing to add to the list, diseases, which again, God forbid, might even be based on biological warfare. Who knows what's going on in China? Yet, God forbid it shouldn't be that, but you know, who knows? So there's a whole list of problems. And that includes lack of water, although Baruch Hashem, that problem is a little better this year. We've had a lot of rain. Even the cost of housing and the cost of cottage cheese. These are problems. And that butter shortage, which I still don't understand what that's based on. But year after year, the number one problem that a majority of respondents have identified, and this is true whether they are religious or secular, Haredi, Dati, Leumi, conservative, reform, Sabra, born in Israel, or Olim, who have come to Israel, is lack of unity and Achdut among the Jewish people. People understand intuitively that when there's unity, there is strength. And when there's machloket, there is weakness and vulnerability. So the great protection against our physical destruction is the not speaking Lashon Hara, which is again symbolic of a unity and a togetherness, a united front. Now, we then come to the second danger, which is that of spiritual assimilation. So here, Rav Meir Simcha tells us, the great bulwark that protects you spiritually is the holiness of the home, the marital bond. You know, people make a mistake. This is something else to think about during the coronavirus. People think that the most important institution in Judaism was the Beit HaMikdash when we had it, and today it would be the Beit Knesset, which is called, in the book of Yechezkel, a Beit Mikdash Ma'at, a miniature Beit HaMikdash. But in reality, the most important institution in Judaism is the home, the bayit, particularly the relationship of husband and wife and mother and father to children. That is where the Shekhinah resides. Chazal say, Ish ve'isha. When a husband and a wife live with shalom, the Shekhinah is there. That is the divine presence. In many ways, the Ramban writes that the various miracles in the temple, such as the eternal light of the menorah that never went out, and the blessing of the showbread that was on the table for more than a week and was warm and fresh when it was eaten a week later, and the cloud of glory that represented a physical manifestation of the Shekhinah, those are the miracles of the temple, the miracles of the Mishkan. They actually correspond with the miracles of the tent of Sarah, Imenu, which there was a blessing in her dough that corresponds to the Lechem upon him. Her Shabbos candle lasted the whole week. That's the Ner Tamid. And there was a cloud of glory. The Ramban says that the miracles of the temple are just an imitation of the temple that we build in a Jewish home. And perhaps this is a time in which we can focus on building the Mikdash of the home. And the Meshech Chachma says it was the relationship of husband and wife which was based on faithfulness, commitment, trust, dependability, even if it was not in a religious context, so to speak, that gave them some spiritual connection to the Shekhinah that prevented them from hitting the 50th level. They still hit the 49th level. They were pretty low. But what kept them from hitting the 50th level was the faithfulness and connection of husband and wife. Right? So if the not speaking Lashon Hara was the antidote to physical threat, the faithfulness of husband and wife was the antidote to spiritual assimilation to the 50th level. Now, the third danger was a slave lacks a sense of history. He doesn't know where he comes from. He has no sense that he comes from something significant and beautiful and important. So here the Meshech Chachma says, not changing the name gives you a sense of history, because typically we name people after relatives who are no longer, well, again, Ashkenazim name them after people who are no longer alive. Sephardim may name someone even after people who are alive. But a name is generally a connection to the past. So if somebody's, let's say, grandfather's was Moshe, and they're called Moshe, then they know they're connected to that earlier Moshe, going all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. Keeping a name reminds you that you didn't come out of nothing. You're connected to a past. You're connected to people of stature, people of goodness. In fact, even the Yiddish diminutives that Ashkenazim use are so telling. You know, we sometimes call little children Bubala, Mamala, Tatala, Zedala. Now, people sometimes look at them as just interchangeable terms of endearment, but not really. Bubala means little grandmother. Zedala, little grandfather. Mamala, little mommy, little mother. Tatala. Meaning, if you name a child out of for a grandfather, grandmother, a deceased mother, deceased father, every time you use that diminutive, you're telling the child, you come from somebody who preceded you. You are standing on the shoulders of giants, of goodness and holiness. So, once again, therefore, the not speaking Lashon Hara is our behavior that protected us from physical threat. The faithfulness of husband and wife prevented our spiritual assimilation. Not changing our names is a linkage to the past, which gives us a sense of history. And then we finally come to the last danger. A person loses a sense of hope. They lose a vision that life can be different. Life can be better. We countered that hopelessness by continuing to speak the Hebrew language. Because think about it. There was a time in history in which Latin was the most widely spoken language in the world, at the height of the Roman Empire, which had conquered virtually all of the known world. Latin was the official language. Today, Latin is virtually extinct. It used to be required in law school and the like, in medical school, no longer. Even the Catholic Church, that was the last holdout, abolished the requirement of Latin for masses. Now there are some Haredi Catholics who don't accept the Pope and they continue to do the mass in Latin, but they are the extreme fringe. Latin is more or less an extinct language. Assyrian, Hittite, these were big cultures. There are academicians that are still compiling Assyrian dictionaries. But there's no real push for the revival of the Assyrian language or Latin. Why is that? Because those cultures are dead. They're not coming back. If they're not coming back, then the only reason to study a language is for a mere academic interest. That's not going to attract a big following. If indeed it was the case that the Jewish people had given up hope that they would come back to Eretz Yisrael, if indeed the Jewish people thought slavery is our lot in life and this is where we will always be, then what would be the point of teaching my child Hebrew? But when I teach my child Hebrew, what am I telling my child in Egypt? We're not going to be here forever. There will come a time. I don't know when. I don't know if it'll be in my lifetime. I don't even know if it'll be in your lifetime. But there will come a time that God is going to redeem us. This is before Moshe Rabbeinu came, right? This is before. This is all those years before there was a Redeemer. That God is going to redeem us. He's going to take care of us. He is going to fulfill the promises that he made to Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. So we need to have our language. Because we're not going to be here forever. One has to understand. To teach my child Hebrew when I don't live in Eretz Yisrael, is a great, great affirmation of hope. And that is why, in many ways, I have to give credit. I think all of us have to give credit to Eliezer ben Yehuda, who, although he was not necessarily the most observant person, and many rabbis had problems with him, he was close to Rav Kook. But Eliezer ben Yehuda was really almost single-handedly revived Lashon HaKodesh, revived the Hebrew language for everyday speech. It was always a literary, it was always the literary language of rabbinic literature, to be sure. But it was not a spoken language, even among many, many great rabbis. And he brought it back. And that's important, because speaking Lashon HaKodesh, and I'm not going to get into the very subtle debate of the relationship of modern Ivrit and Lashon HaKodesh. One can write books about this. There have been books written on this. But at a very minimum, we can say Lashon HaKodesh and Ivrit are very, very close siblings, or at least first cousins. They're close enough that they're really, you know, if one understands one, one can understand the other. So let's see the beautiful, intricate maracha that the Meshech Chachma sets up. Four lashonot of redemption are because of four dangers. The four dangers are danger to physical survival, spiritual assimilation, lack of history, lack of hope. But the reason we merited the redemption from those four dangers was because there's four behaviors on our part that countermanded those dangers. The not speaking Lashon Hara, which is Achdut and Avat Yisrael, protects us from the physical threat. The faithfulness of the marital bond keeps us spiritually holy. The names that connect us to our forefathers and foremothers is our connection to history. And our lovingly preserving Lashon HaKodesh is our declaration of hope that we're not going to be here forever. Four Lashonot of redemption, four dangers, four behaviors. So now I'll give you a fourth component, Dave. A fourth way that these four ideas intersect. That is, let's examine where we drink the cups during the Seder. And let me point out, it's very important that you drink them in the proper places. I mean, you can't just start a Seder, drink four cups of wine, and let's get the wine over with. You have to drink them exactly where it says. And not only that, not only drink them where it says it, but pour the wine. You'll notice that we actually pour the wine, let's say, way before we drink it. You can't just pour the wine before you drink it, because the Maggid, for example, has to be recited over wine, even though it may be an hour or so till you drink it. So please be sure, all of you, that you follow the instructions of the Haggadah, both in terms of when you drink and when you fill your cup, because you're reciting things over a cup of wine. Just like for Kiddush, right? You wouldn't recite Kiddush and then fill your cup of wine before you drink it. You fill your cup of wine before Kiddush. So the same thing is true for before Maggid, before benching, and before the recitation of Hallel. Now, the first cup is the cup of Kiddush. Kiddush is a term that means holiness, sanctification. That corresponds to the holiness also of husband and wife and the marital unit. So the first cup could be seen, in fact, marriage is called Kiddushin, sanctification. So the first cup is a celebration not only of God's redemption, but of our behavior and faithfulness of husband and wife that enabled Kedushah, which therefore saved us from spiritual assimilation. The second cup is on Maggid. Maggid, of course, is the story of the Exodus. What is the Maggid about? Our history. Our past. That corresponds to not changing our names. It's a celebration of that merit, because the Maggid reminds us we don't come out of nowhere. We have a history. We have avot with whom Hashem made covenants. We have ancestors to whom Hashem did miracles. And when we have a sense of that history, that gives us optimism that Hashem is with us. So the second cup is the connection to history. The third cup is Birkat HaMazon. Now this, the association is a little more subtle, but Birkat HaMazon is of course an expression of gratitude to God for giving us food and giving us sustenance. Now Pirkei Avot tells us, Eizeyu Chacham, I'm sorry, Eizeyu Ashir, who is a truly wealthy person? Hasameach b'chelko, when you're happy with your lot. Wealth is not defined by how much you own, but actually by how little you need, one might say. Instead of how much you have, it's how little can make you happy. And the greatest bracha in life is to be sameach b'chelko. Now, if Birkat HaMazon teaches me gratitude, and when there is gratitude, I am sameach b'chelko. I no longer live a life of jealousy, rivalry, or competition. So consequently, I'm able to have achdus and unity with my fellow man, because I no longer look at them as a threat. I no longer look at life as a zero-sum game where it's your gain is my loss. I can live life with a sense of shalom, friendship, cooperation, collaboration. And that in turn corresponds to the united front, which protected us physically, and our zechus was we didn't speak Lashon Hara. Finally, we come to Hallel. Now, if you study this, the Haggadah, and indeed it's proper to study the Haggadah before Pesach, you will notice that one of the anomalies in the Haggadah is that the Hallel of Seder night is actually split into two unequal halves. The first two chapters of Hallel are actually recited before the second cup, and they are the conclusion of Magid, the narrative of Yetziat Mitzrayim. The rest of Hallel is recited after the meal, after the Afikomen, after benching, on the fourth cup. So we actually split Hallel. What is the significance of the split of Hallel? So the Rishayim explain that the first two chapters of Hallel are talking about the Exodus. Indeed, the second chapter says, B'tseis Yisrael Mimitzrayim, when they left Mitzrayim. They are past-oriented. And because they are past-oriented, they are connected to the Magid that deals with the past event of Yetziat Mitzrayim. But the Hallel on cup number 4 is no longer about Yetziat Mitzrayim. It is the Hallel anticipating and envisioning the future redemption. And here I just want to make a little commercial about that. You know, sometimes many people simply tune out after the Afikomen. Kind of, you know, we've done the Afikomen, we've done the Magid, we've had four cups, well, we haven't had the fourth cup yet, but we've had three cups of wine. And in the Hallel, you know, you're not even allowed to talk, you're not allowed to offer interpretations. Once you're saying Hallel, you can't be mopsik. So there's not a lot to do. Now, one thing that I highly recommend, and I'm sure many, many, many people do it, is this is a part of the Seder that you can sing. Hallel can be put to very, very beautiful songs, and this might be a time for singing. But if you don't know the Nigunim, and you're not that conversant with Hebrew, so Hallel can be a little less interesting for some people. So I know people, maybe they're not so religious necessarily, who kind of leave after the Afikomen. Which is unfortunate because they're missing the fourth cup and they're missing Hallel. But one has to understand that there's something very elevated, very special, very holy about the Hallel on the fourth cup. Because until now, we were focusing on the past. But now we leave the past. We leave the details of the Exodus of Egypt. And our mind and our heart are focused on an ultimate redemption. The redemption that we haven't yet experienced, but we begin to envision in our mind's eye. And that brings us joy. And that is why, by the way, the hallow of the fourth cup is preceded by the pouring of the cup of Elijah and by the opening of the door, welcoming Eliyahu HaNavi. Now, countless parents have told their children, Eliyahu HaNavi comes to every Seder and he takes a sip of Eliyahu's cup. And if you watch the cup carefully, you will see the wine go down. And the parent might bump the table or whatever it is. I'm not sure how many parents still do that, but when I was young, that was a common little trick. Now, just to set the record straight, there is indeed a medrash that says Eliyahu HaNavi comes to every Pesach Seder. And this is actually a punishment, because at some point, when he felt that the Jewish people were so unfaithful to God that God ought to replace them. And Eliyahu HaNavi said, they annul your covenant. Hashem said, oh yeah? Well, I'm going to show you they keep my covenant. You're going to have to go to every bris. Eliyahu HaNavi comes to every bris. And you have to go to every Pesach Seder, because even Jews who aren't so religious try to keep a Pesach Seder. So there is indeed midrashic sources that Eliyahu HaNavi comes to every Seder, but I don't believe there's any source that he drinks from the cup. Okay, but be it as it may, Eliyahu HaNavi, who is Eliyahu HaNavi? He's the one that's going to announce Mashiach. So we're kind of saying, okay, we finished the Seder of the past. We're now focused on the Seder of the future. But what is that but an affirmation of hope that things will be better? Life is not going to stay this way forever and ever. So, look at the beautiful intricate structure that we have here. Four lashonot of redemption, because there were four dangers that we faced. And the four dangers that we faced were countermanded by four behaviors on our part. And they are positioned throughout the Seder, although not exactly in the same order. The Kos of Kiddush is a celebration of Kiddushin, the marital bond. The Kos of Magid is our connection to history that corresponded to our not changing our names. The Kos of Birchat HaMazon facilitates solidarity and Achdut, because it gives me the Sameach B'Chelko, the happiness in what God has given me, which takes away jealousy and rivalry and competitiveness. And finally, the Hallel after the Seder is the affirmation of hope that there will be a better time. And that corresponded to the Jews speaking Lashon HaKodesh, which was their affirmation of hope that things are going to be better. Now, it's interesting, we sometimes look at the Jews who left Egypt and we say, oh, they were so bad, the 49th level of impurity. Well, even though they were in the 49th level of impurity, they had these four zechuyot. Let's ask ourselves, how much of the Jewish world has these four zechuyot even today? Zechut number one was being faithful in our marriage and not intermarrying. Litzareinu, to our great pain and suffering, at least in the United States, which I'm more familiar with those numbers, at least one out of two marriages with a Jewish partner are to a non-Jew. And in some smaller areas, it is as high as 7 out of 10. What a tragedy it is. People don't like to compare it to the Holocaust, but in a very, very real way. Of course, it's unintentional and not castigating people, but in a very real way, the number of Jews that are lost through the scourge of intermarriage is really a Holocaust. Millions and millions of Jews. So that zechus we don't have. The second zechus, not speaking Lashon Hara, which is unity and solidarity among the Jewish people. All of us know that the Second Temple was destroyed because of hatred and polarization among Jews, and it cannot be rebuilt until we overcome that hatred and polarization. And here, all of us know how much divisiveness, how much machloket, how much sinat chinam exists, not only between religious and secular, but among all the different gradations of religious, in which we don't talk to each other, we don't interact, we don't learn from each other, we don't respect each other. Anyone to the right of me is a fanatic, and anyone to the left of me is a heretic, an apikoros. It's only where I am, whoever the I is, that is, the emes. And sometimes that could be so narrow that it might just be one person. Only me. The whole world is crazy. So we don't have that zichus. The third, connecting to our history. So many Jews have no sense of where they come from. When I used to teach law school, one of my colleagues, who was a religious law professor, told me that after class one day, a boy went over to him and said, "Hey, I know you're a rabbi also. Did you ever hear of this guy, Elijah of Vilna?" People tell me he was like a big shot rabbi. This is the Vilna Gaon. So the person said, the professor said, it was a rabbi, said, "The Gaon of Vilna, the greatest of the greatest of the greatest." The person said, "Yeah, he's like my great-great-great-grandfather. I heard he was like a big shot rabbi in Europe." Didn't even know the Vilna Gaon. Our roots, we just don't have a sense of where we come from. And hope that the future will be different. Well, maybe the Jewish people are not in despondency. Maybe that's not the issue. But there's certainly a lot of complacency. Here we have a state of Israel that has been in existence for more than 70 years. Our forefathers, our foremothers, yearned and pined for the chance to perhaps see Eretz Yisrael once in their lifetime, for the chance to see some dirt that somebody brought back to Poland. And here, the person might be just 12 hours away, granted, an uncomfortable 10 or 12 hour El Al flight. But you know, it's not the biggest deprivation of the world. And we give lip service to Mashiach. But do we really want Mashiach to go? You know, they tell the joke, it's kind of a sad joke, but it may have a kernel of truth, about a guy who was planning his vacation, a religious Jew. And the day before his vacation, Mashiach came. And the guy had to cancel his plans. So he was upset. So his wife said, "Well, how can you be upset, Mashiach?" He said, "You know, he kept us waiting 2,000 years. He couldn't come 2 weeks later. I could have gotten my vacation." Meaning, we have to ask ourselves, again, I include myself. I don't mean to lecture to anybody, but we have to ask ourselves, do we really want Mashiach to come? Are we kind of happy the way things are? You know, life could be convenient, life could be simple. And I don't want all of these changes. So in a sense, do we have hope for the future? Or do we kind of assume that with glad kosher restaurants and Pesach programs and voyages, whatever it would be, we have everything we need? So the point I want to make is that we sometimes look down at that generation that left Mitzrayim, because they were in the 49th level of Tumah, and yet they had four zechuyot that we don't always have in our own lives. Right? They were faithful in their marriages to Jews. There was group solidarity, Avat Yisrael. There was a strong connection to history. And there was hope for the future. Again, to go back to what I said at the very beginning of my remarks, some of this, once again, might be the silver lining in the dark cloud of the difficult situation that we face. Because maybe this type of adversity makes us, number one, cherish our relationships to others, and number two, makes us less complacent and less satisfied with the life that we have, because we can see how difficult it is, and perhaps this can spur us on to yearn for Mashiach and Geula. So even the virus can be a shaliach of Hashem to bring us closer to each other and closer to the Almighty. So I want to wish you all a Chag Kasher v'Sameach, even if Pesach might be a little more lonely than it usually is. But you should know that as the Jewish people, we are still united in soul and in spirit, even if we're not going to be physically connected. And most importantly, you're not alone. Hashem will be with you the Seder night, just as that first of Yetzias Mitzrayim, Ani v'lo malach, Hashem said, it was I and no angel. Ani v'lo saraf, Ani v'lo shaliach, no emissary. So too, every Seder night where we re-experience Yetzias Mitzrayim, right, each person must regard themselves as if they were taken out of Mitzrayim. God is going to be with us that very, very night. And therefore, we have to know we are not alone. We are never alone. Have a good Yom Tov.